Today's podcast focuses on the management of patients with glaucoma. A lot is happening in the field, as you can see in a draft form of the American Optometric Association's new guidelines, which became available for public review in March. As the AOA notes, the goal of treatment is to minimize the risk of visual impairment over the lifetime of the patient while also minimizing the expense and side effects of treatment. Also, management of primary open-angle glaucoma calls for an individualized treatment plan and may utilize medical, laser, and/or surgical interventions. We spoke to a panel of optometrists for their insights on managing patients with topicals, drug-eluting stents, and MIGS devices. First, Dr. Danica Morelli shares her perspectives on choosing the initial therapy, keeping the long view in mind when treating patients, and applying an understanding of the underlying structures involved in aqueous drainage.
Initial patient decisions really sort of fall under theoretical and practical. So in terms of theoretical, you know, you have to ask yourself, is this patient going to be a laser first patient or a medicine first patient? We certainly have good information from the LIGHT trial that tells us that SLT is a really valid first line therapy. That being said, I would say 99% of my new starts, new diagnosis patients are medicine first. If you're going to go medicine first, prostaglandin is going to hands down be the best choice in terms of efficacy, tolerability, side effect profile, that sort of thing. And so then you sort of get to the practical matter of who's paying for this medication. Is this a commercial payer? Then maybe I'm going to be able to get a good copay card and go with a branded product. Is this a patient with no insurance? I'm probably going to need to go generic or, you know, really think about cost. You also want to think about things like, does this patient have a reason for me to look for an unpreserved or an alternately preserved formulation? Of course, every once in a while, we have a patient that shouldn't use a PGA. And so those are going to be patients who maybe need unilateral therapy or a patient who had post-cataract surgery, cystoid macular edema. And then you're going to look at your next first line therapy. So typically a beta blocker, I think we could consider Notarcidil as an alternative first line therapy, which still has good efficacy and really good dosing at once a day. I often talk to my students about glaucoma management being like playing a chess game. So I don't play chess, but I know that you have to lay out your game plan, and you're not just making one decision at a time. You're making one move, thinking about how that move is going to set up the next one. Glaucoma is a lifelong disease. It is a marathon, not a sprint. And so the decisions that we make today have to be made with what's going to happen in the future. When I look at a patient, when I make the initial diagnosis of glaucoma, I look at that patient and I say, how old are they? How advanced is this glaucoma? What does my target pressure need to be? If I'm looking at a patient who's very young, has moderate to severe glaucoma, I'm already going to be thinking about having the surgery conversation. Even though we go through all of the steps leading up to surgery, I'm going to have that surgery decision, or surgery conversation, I should say, early in the process to let them know, you know, you're likely to be a patient who's going to end up having a surgical procedure, so that when it comes time for that, they're not surprised. I'm not saying that those patients are going to be surgery first patients, but thinking about, okay, I know that this patient's likely to need surgery. I'm going to have that decision early on. But also, I think we think about it in terms of our stepped therapy. You know, SLT works better when the patient's pressure is higher. So I don't want to max out my patient on medications and then say, oh, let's try SLT. Because at that point, SLT is not very likely to have a significant impact. So if I know I'm going to need an aggressive target pressure, I'm going to put SLT in there pretty early when the pressure is higher and SLT still has a really good chance of being efficacious. I also think about, you know, if I put, let's say I start a patient on a prostaglandin and then they have SLT and I want to add another medication, If I add a medication like a beta blocker or like brimonidine, I know that the next step is quite easy to switch that medication to a fixed dose combination. So it's always thinking about, okay, how does the decision that I make today impact the next decision that I'm going to make? I think about the ways that we can lower IOP kind of being like a sink or a bathtub that's going to overflow. We can either turn off the tap, decrease aqueous production, or we can open up the drain and get the water out of that bathtub, right? So in the eye, we have two pathways. We have the conventional pathway that is about, the trabecular pathway, about, oh, so probably somewhere close to 80% of the aqueous leaves the eye through the conventional pathway, and the remaining 20% leaves through the uveoscleral pathway. I think it's interesting that for probably 25 years or more, we haven't really been using drugs that target the trabecular meshwork or the conventional outflow. And we know that that's where the problem is. It's resistance to outflow through the conventional pathway that causes elevated IOP in our primary open-angle glaucoma patients. So if that's where the problem is, to me, it makes sense that we want to target that problem. We haven't had any drugs that could do that until about 5 years ago. We now have the nitric oxide releasing latanoprostene Bunod that affects both outflow pathways. It increases uveoscleral outflow, just like our PGAs, and then the nitric oxide enhances trabecular or conventional outflow. And we also have an increase in trabecular outflow with Notarcidil, and that's its main mechanism of action. So I think that if we know there's a problem part of the eye, I think we ought to be targeting that with our therapeutic intervention.
In December, the FDA approved a travoprost intracameral implant for patients with open-angle glaucoma or ocular hypertension. It's intended for a single use per eye. We spoke with Dr. Justin Schweitzer prior to this approval about appropriate patient selection for drug-eluting implants, which also include the bimatoprost implant. He also discusses patient education on these implants and the rationale for using a one-time therapy.
We do have one on the market, bimatoprost SR, which is an intracameral implant. The indication for that particular implant is for any patients with open-angle glaucoma or ocular hypertension. So they have to have an open angle. I think that's one important piece. We don't want to implant this in someone that has, narrow angles. I think the other thing to keep in mind when we define open-angle glaucoma, that can be pigmentary glaucoma, that can be exfoliative glaucoma. Those are all still types of open-angle glaucomas. And the way we determine that is with gonioscopy, making sure the angle's open. And so those are all appropriate patients to consider. I think the other patient types that you want to consider with a implant like bimatoprost SR would be a patient that complains about cost of their medication. They feel like they're spending too much on their medications. Can we give them a break with something like this? We can. An ocular surface disease patient is ideal for this. We need to control their glaucoma because that medication is going to be inside the eye. We're going to be able to control their intraocular pressure. We're going to be able to give them that drop holiday or a break from their drops to control their intraocular pressure as well. I think the non-compliant patient would be another one. And through your investigations of working with your patients, you're going to understand, are they compliant or are they non-compliant? And you can utilize this as well. And then I think the patient this shouldn't be placed in would be a patient, as I mentioned earlier, with narrow angles, or a patient that has any type of corneal condition. If they have corneal guttata, if they're a patient that has, Fuchs dystrophy, as mentioned, if they're a patient that has had any type of cornea transplant, whether it be a full thickness cornea transplant, a DMECC, a DSEC, that would be a contraindication. We don't want to utilize it. And then I think we need to be careful with patients that have any type of active inflammation inside the eye, macular edema, any type of iritises. We want to be careful with implanting something inside the eye. So those would be the warnings and precautions around that type of implant. So the way that we educate patients, the way that we use words is very, very important. And that doesn't mean we should mislead our patients. We still should educate them properly on advantages, disadvantages, risks of different treatment options. But when we talk about something like selective laser trabeculoplasty or laser, I don't mind using the word laser, but I avoid saying things like, we're going to shoot that laser into your eye. I think there's other ways that we can mention it. We're going to use a treatment that utilizes laser to lower your intraocular pressure. Sounds much, much better. When we're talking about intracameral implants, yes, there's a needle involved. Yes, it penetrates the cornea and it is injected into the eye. But trying to at least leave out the word needle, trying to leave out the word injectable, and saying things like, we're going to place this drug delivery device inside your eye to help lower your intraocular pressure, sounds much, much better than we're going to stick a needle in your eye, implant this device to lower your intraocular pressure. And again, it's not to mislead a patient. We're still educating them properly. And if they ask, how is it done? Then you explain it's done in a very quick, easy way. It's done at the slit lamp. The only thing you have to do afterwards is take an antibiotic for about 3 to 4 days, and you can go on living your normal life. Goes so far in educating these patients around these procedures that definitely can make an impact in a variety of different scenarios, as we talked about earlier. When we think about the Bimatoprost implant that's available right now, it is indicated for just one-time use, but I wouldn't let that obstruct you from utilizing it in your patient population for a variety of different reasons. When we look at the structure of it, once it's implanted, it elutes drug and it elutes that medication for about 4 months. Although it only elutes medication for 4 months, there's a phase 1 and 2 clinical trial that has shown that the efficacy of iopilorin can actually last much longer than that. In that particular study, you know, over half of patients went 6 months with IOP lowering, just under half of patients went out to a year of IOP lowering, and about a quarter of the patients went out to 2 years with IOP lowering. And so although it's only eluting for 4 months, the efficacy of it may be longer. Even though we're only able to implant one of these, I think the usefulness of it is we have to keep in mind what glaucoma is as a disease process. It's a marathon. Anything that we prescribe, whether it be drops, whether it be we do SLT, whether it be a surgical procedure, none of those particular procedures or treatments is going to last forever. And so very similarly with this Bimatoprost implant, it's not going to last forever. But if we can buy our patients some time from either being less dependent on drops or independent of drops, even if it's for 6 months, a year, or 2 years, we could be doing those patients a favor, not only to their ocular surface, but maybe to their quality of life, maybe to their pocketbook and checkbook. And so there's a variety of reasons to at least consider it, even though it's only a one-time indication of use.
And finally, Dr. Thomas Chester shares some big picture perspectives on the role of optometrists in discussing minimally invasive glaucoma surgery, or MIGS, devices with their patients.
I think the important aspect to understand about the different MIGS opportunities are a couple different things. So first of all would be location. You know, what part of the anatomy, what part of the angle, what part of the eye are we actually using or trying to work to improve, whether that be in the trabecular meshwork or the uveal scleral pathway, you know, things like that. So I think understanding anatomical location is probably the first differentiator. Other differentiators would be whether or not we can do it in the time of cataract surgery, so in conjunction with other ocular procedures, or if it can be done as a standalone procedure. And then I think the third differentiator would be based on the level of glaucoma severity. And so some of the MIGS procedures are for mild, moderate procedures. Others can be done in severe cases. And so I think understanding kind of the level and grade of the disease process can help differentiate that. So I think it's an important aspect as the co-managing optometrist to understand the full picture. And that's the nice thing about the co-managing optometrist, because they do know these patients. They've seen these patients for some time. And so they are probably in the best position to identify not only what the severity of their condition is, but also maybe things that they've tried in the past, other concomitant issues like cataracts, and if those things need to be addressed at the same time or not. And so it can help to present a good, full, well-rounded picture to the surgeon so that we can kind of help fine-tune which MIGS should be the best consideration. So patients who are currently on topical therapy for glaucoma can definitely be benefited with MIGS procedures in a couple different ways. So we all know the burden that's placed on these patients with medications, whether that's actual having to take the medications every day and actually squeezing that bottle dropper in their eyes, dealing with ocular surface issues from, you know, preservatives from the medication or multiple medications and that toxicity to the corneal surface. To insurance plans and whether or not insurance companies are going to cover the medication or not. Those are kind of all things that lie on the patient. In addition, it can also, you know, burden our staff in the sense of, you know, now it takes them time to fill out the prior authorizations, go through, you know, multiple rejections as far as getting the insurance to cover the medications for them. And then, you know, even beyond that, then you worry about multiple visits because, you know, maybe the patient's not taking their drops the way they're supposed to. So MIGS can help in relieving a lot of those burdens. And in addition, it can help to ensure compliance because it's taking away that burden on the patient of them having to constantly keep up with this progressive condition by taking that out of their hands and doing a treatment and doing a procedure. One of the key benefits or one of the key factors of education for the co-managing optometrist to understand is how to set the appropriate expectations. And I really encourage the optometrist not to tell the patients or not to promise the patients that they'll be off of their medications or even promise them that they'll be reduced from having to take the burden of medications. But I do think that educating them that this treatment does affect the condition and that there are possibilities to either maybe not need as many medications in the future or possibly reduce their drop burden now, I think it's leaving that open-ended. Everybody responds differently to medications. Patients respond differently to procedures. In some cases, this prevents patients from needing more medication added. In other patients, it actually can have them take away some medications because it gives them the similar effect. So I think giving them the proper education as far as what to expect is key and informing them of the things that we might be able to reduce if things go as planned with the way they heal, but not overemphasizing those results and just kind of giving them that these are potential possibilities. I think that's the key. The role of a co-managing optometrist is actually very important in the process of you know, co-managing these patients. And the reason being is that as a co-managing optometrist, you've seen these patients for an extended period of time. You know their lifestyle, you know what their expectations are, you know the challenges that they have, whether it's living by themselves, if they have a caregiver, if they have, arthritis and maybe have more of a challenge with drops, if they are anti-pharmaceuticals and they don't want to use medications, and just overall, you know what their ocular surface looks like because you've been monitoring them for a significant amount of time. I think those are all key aspects to setting up the proper expectations. Number one, setting up the proper expectations with the patient so that they can kind of expect that, you know, hey, we're going to do the best we can to potentially reduce your drop burden. And so you get to be the first person to kind of give that message. Certainly when the patient gets to the surgeon's practice, they reinforce that message that we will do the best we can to potentially reduce your drop burden and give you extra protection. And then following up afterwards, it's also important to communicate the results back and forth. And so let the surgeon know exactly how the patient's doing in that post-operative timeframe. If there's any concerns or questions that the patient has or that you have, make sure you communicate that back and forth because it is a partnership. It's a partnership between the surgeon's practice and your practice, and you are that conduit to good care for the patient.